It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, the movie Back to the Future turns 30 years old today. We'll talk to a guest about why the film remains a classic to this day. First, an anniversary a little closer to home. 5 years ago this Sunday, Wisconsin's indoor smoking ban went into effect. It banned smoking in all enclosed workplaces in the state, including all bars, restaurants, lodging establishments, and private clubs. It's hard to remember that only 5 years ago, restaurants had smoking and non-smoking sections, except in cities with their own bans, and that the expectation was that any bar in the state was going to be filled with smoke. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. 5 years later, what do you think of the ban? Are you happy with the results, or do you wish you could still light up at a restaurant or a bar? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Here with us now is Allison Miller, Media Advocacy Director for the Central Region of the American Cancer Society. Allison, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, take us back to the effort leading up to this ban 5 years ago Sunday. Why was Wisconsin's indoor smoking ban sought and put into place?
Well, as is the case across the country, you know, there's a movement and continues to be a movement to get secondhand smoke out of all workplaces because, frankly, there is no safe level of secondhand smoke exposure. There are thousands of chemicals, dozens of which are proven to be known carcinogens. And so, you know, it's really a matter of making sure that people are not needlessly exposed to cancer-causing agents, and we can continue to move forward with reducing the state's tobacco burden. So it was, you know, certainly something that was discussed in the state for many years and was a long time coming. And now 5 years after it's been in place, I think public opinion polls show that 86% of Wisconsinites support the law, which is, you know, much more than even when the law first went into effect or just a few years ago. And people, like you said in your introduction, expect when they sit down for dinner or they go out with friends for a drink that they're not going to have to be exposed to secondhand smoke.
Do we have any information, any data yet on the health impacts of having this ban in place?
Yeah, I mean, there's data that comes nationwide and some that was done in the immediate years when the law first took effect in Wisconsin. In fact, just in the first 3 to 6 months after the smoke-free air law went into effect in the state, there was a study done with bartender health, and bar workers had experienced significant improvement in their respiratory health. There was about a 36% decrease in bartenders reporting that they had wheezing or shortness of breath, that they had sore throats, and that they were feeling sick, and that was conducted by the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. There was also some studies on the air quality inside inside bars and restaurants that had greatly improved. The small particulate matter that causes those respiratory problems had been reduced by 92%. So, you know, that's just two particular studies here in Wisconsin. There are numerous studies across the country that indicate, you know, heart attack rates decline, that people, you know, actually employers benefit in that there are fewer sick days, employees are healthier, and as are patrons.
Now, the research you mentioned alludes to this a little, but can you just spell out the effects of secondhand smoke in enclosed places, given the state of the art of the research right now?
As far as what is known about secondhand smoke?
The health impacts, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the prolonged exposure to secondhand smoke is proven to cause cancer in non-smoking adults, as well as be a significant contributor to heart attacks, strokes, and other emphysema, respiratory illnesses, essentially all of the same effects that smokers suffer just by exposure to that secondhand smoke. You know, each year Wisconsin sees about 7,000 deaths that are directly tied to smoking, and there's about, if I remember correctly, about 700 or so that can be attributed to secondhand smoke. Secondhand smoke, you know, causes all of, like I said, all of the same conditions that smokers deal with, except that in the case in Wisconsin before the law went into effect, there were employees that were being exposed to that without any choice in the matter.
We're talking to Allison Miller from the American Cancer Society about the five-year anniversary this Sunday of Wisconsin's workplace smoking ban. It affects our lives mostly at restaurants and bars, banning smoking in those locations. We'll go now to your calls at 800-642-1234. We've got David on the line with us in Sparta. David, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think of this?
I'm a smoker myself, and I completely agree with the restaurant part, the restaurant side of it. I have a wife, I have two kids, and even when I could smoke in restaurants, I wasn't due to my family. Now, if I'm going to go out on the town with my wife and we're going to go to a bar, it's becoming discriminatory to me. It used to come with the territory, and you're able to smoke in a bar. Now I do feel like it's discrimination. The laws are starting to change now where they're not even wanting you to smoke in your kid in the car if you have kids that will ever be in that car. So that's a law that I've seen. There's some buildings you can't even smoke within 50 feet of. And so it's we can't smoke in places where we're going to go drink, you know, or have a beverage. And now you can't smoke outside some vehicles. They're trying to put it where you can't even smoke in your own vehicle if you're a smoker and you have children.
Gotcha, David. So, Allison, first of all, his point that it's going so far. He was okay with it in restaurants. It's going so far, he says, that it's making life unfairly difficult for smokers.
I think in this particular case, the law really did just affect workplaces. So when you're talking about the difference between bars and restaurants, you know, there's no difference to those employees in their health between whether you work in a bar or you work in a restaurant, or most often they're both bars and restaurants really combined. And so, you know, your bartender doesn't necessarily have any less right to smoke-free air and good health than, you know, your wait staff in a restaurant. As far as the other concerns when it comes to restrictions, a lot of those are your local ordinances or their other private, you know, whether it's a hospital ground that decides you can't smoke in a certain distance. You know, we're really focused here in this case on making sure that all employees have that protection so that no worker has to choose between, you know, their paycheck or their health.
David, thanks for the call. Another thing I was kind of taken from that was that bars aren't places we go to expecting healthy behavior, whether as patrons or employees. It's a different scene. We choose to go there or not. And to work there or not, I suppose. So maybe that could be a zone where smoking is okay. Obviously, under the law, it currently isn't.
Well, and I think that was a debate that was had extensively before the law was passed, whether, you know, bars should be considered somehow different than any other workplace. But again, to say that people have a choice doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, if you're working or living in a small town, perhaps you don't have that many employment choices. Or why should that bartender have to go find a different job simply because they're somehow their health isn't valued the same as wait staff health? Or, you know, as far as a patron goes, and let's say you're a cancer survivor or you're somebody with respiratory problems, you know, you deserve just as much of a right to go out and have a good time with your friends and family and expect that clean indoor air as anyone else. And, you know, to step outside, like the gentleman said he had done before, it's become more and more just automatic and expected. I don't think it was an undue burden for folks to just step outside.
Well, moving ahead to the state of the art today, we have e-cigarettes and vaping now. I don't know that the word vaping existed 5 years ago. Is this something you're looking at, vaping in these locations where we currently can't smoke indoors?
Well, I think there's a lot that's unknown about electronic cigarettes. And like you said, yeah, 5 years ago, nobody would even know what you meant if you said somebody was vaping. And so the sudden and very dramatic increase in electronic cigarette use is certainly something that the American Cancer Society researchers are looking at as far as what is in these devices, as well as what we're looking at policy-wise and the public health ramifications. I think it's far too soon to say anything about what the science says, just because it is so new. But when it comes to using e-cigarettes indoors in places where smoking is otherwise prohibited, you know, it's certainly something we would encourage that people take outside as well, not only because we don't know what's in this aerosol that's being emitted, we don't know what chemicals are in it, and some of the preliminary science is concerning, but also because it renormalizes and potentially glamorizes the act of smoking again for both kids and for everybody to see, you know, that behavior once again indoors risks kind of backsliding on some of the progress that we've made in tobacco control and curbing smoking.
Allison, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Allison Miller, Media Advocacy Director for the Central Region of the American Cancer Society, talking about Wisconsin's indoor smoking ban went into effect 5 years ago Sunday. Over at the Central Time Facebook page, Albert writes, "I can remember all the predictions of this being the end of the restaurant and bar scene. Hasn't happened that way. I think the people who smoke have done well to adapt to the change." What do you think? Share your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll talk about the All-American hot dog just in time for the 4th of July. First, one of the most beloved movies of the last half century is celebrating a big anniversary today.
Doc, I'm from the future. I came here in a time machine that you invented. Now I need your help to get back to the year 1985.
On July 3rd, 1985, Back to the Future hit the big screen, becoming a widely popular hit, launching a trilogy that some people put up there with Star Wars and Indiana Jones. And while we're on the subject of sequels, you might remember that Back to the Future Part 2 took us to a fictional depiction of the distant future 2015. Well, things didn't turn out quite like they did in the films. Hoverboards and self-lacing sneakers, maybe not too far away. Well, 30 years later, we ask, what was the secret to the movie's success? Where do we still see its impact today? Cassin Gaines joins us now. He's the author of We Don't Need Roads, the making of the Back to the Future trilogy. Cassin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you interviewed a lot of the principals in the movie here. When they launched this movie 30 years ago, did anybody have an idea that it was going to become this pop culture phenomenon?
They really didn't. It's one of those things where everyone involved had a lot of faith in Robert Zemeckis and his co-writer and producer, Bob Gale, in terms of their script. They all thought it was a fantastic script even before they started filming. But, you know, filmmaking is hard to sort of tell whether or not things are gelling. Of course, they shot a lot of the film with Eric Stoltz before Michael J. Fox was brought on board to play Marty McFly. And even during that period of time, they really didn't know whether or not the film was working. So they didn't know that it was going to be something special, and they were really all caught by surprise when the film debuted to such big numbers.
And we'll get into that leading man story in a little bit. But big picture, Back to the Future was kind of like Jaws in making a new precedent to how to make that summer blockbuster big. How did it do that?
Well, I think the first thing is that Back to the Future starts with a really creative story. This idea that you can take a teenager, have him go back in time and meet his parents as teenagers and have to set them up is really unusual. It's so simplistic, but it's really original. The other thing that I think is sort of interesting and why this film has resonated with people is this idea of time travel. There isn't a person that doesn't wish that they could go back and change one aspect of their life, a conversation they had, or even a wrong turn maybe that led to a car accident or something like that. And the Back to the Future films, especially that first film, really points to this idea that each moment in your life matters. And if you can always do the right thing, your life will turn out fantastically.
Well, you point out in the book, though, that the time travel plot was a reason that the movie almost didn't get made. Movie makers thought it might be too complicated in some ways. There had been other recent time travel movies, I guess, that hadn't done that well. And it's tough to do it right. So how did they do time travel right in Back to the Future?
I think they did time travel right because the story of Back to the Future at its heart is really a familial story. It's a story of Marty and Doc's friendship. It's a story of Marty's relationship with his parents and his family. Marty sort of realizing his parents' self-worth. And the time travel aspect is really a vehicle into, well, I guess no pun intended with the DeLorean, but it's really a vehicle into telling that story. It's really a character-driven film in a lot of ways. You know, we think about Back to the Future sometimes as a special effects movie or something like that, but there really aren't that many special effects or visual effects in that first film. And so I think what separates Back to the Future from those other time travel movies of the 80s is that it's not really gimmicky in the same sort of way.
And now Michael J. Fox was a big picture of that human story, but it was a roundabout path to bring him on. And I hadn't realized, I'd heard the Eric Stoltz thing that he was the original guy. I hadn't realized they'd filmed a lot of the movie with him and started again. Bring us up to that story.
Yeah, originally Robert Zemeckis and Steven Spielberg wanted Michael J. Fox, but Michael J. Fox was unavailable because of his family ties schedule. And so the head of the studio was very interested in casting Eric Stoltz. Eric Stoltz wasn't even the second choice. Really, C. Thomas Howell, who went on to do Soul Man after being passed over for Back to the Future, was the second choice, but Sid Sheinberg, who was an executive at Universal, wanted Eric. So they filmed with Eric for a long period of time, about 6 weeks. About 40% of the film was in the can, and Robert Zemeckis watched the footage and realized that Eric Stoltz just wasn't getting the laughs that that they had thought that he would deliver. He is a very serious actor. He's a method actor, and he approached the work almost too seriously. The analogy I sort of use is like if you cast Meryl Streep as Melissa McCarthy's role in Bridesmaids. You know, it's not a referendum on Meryl Streep's acting ability. It would just be casting the wrong person in the wrong part. So they fired Eric Stoltz after they got assurances that Michael J. Fox would be able to work it out with his family ties schedule, and the rest is history.
This is a weird thing for a movie, right? I mean, a lot of times you might just cut bait, make the best movie you can with what you've got so far. Is it common that far into the game to replace your lead actor?
That actually had never been done prior to Back to the Future and has never been done since. It's kind of remarkable, especially when you consider that Robert Zemeckis at that point in his career was not, you know, the Academy Award-winning director of Forrest Gump and, you know, Who Framed Roger Rabbit and all these great films. He was someone who was really just fortunate to have a job. But he had such conviction and belief in this idea that he wanted to make the best movie that he could, and was willing to fight for recasting the leading man, even though it cost Universal almost $4 million to do that.
We were talking to Cassin Gaines, author of the book We Don't Need Roads. It is the 30th anniversary today of the release of the first Back to the Future movie. Now, another character, another actor that wasn't really scheduled to be in it, well, not really an actor, it was the DeLorean, the car that gets turned into a time machine. How did that end up, that weird but iconic car, end up in the movie?
Well, like so many things with Back to the Future, this really came down to timing. Bob Zemeckis and Bob Gale started working on this script in 1980. And at the time, the DeLorean wasn't even commercially available. The time machine initially was a chamber, like a refrigerator, and they would drive it around in the back of a pickup truck. And the finale of the movie, instead of being at the clock tower with the lightning, was going to be in Nevada with at a nuclear reactor site that would generate the 1.21 gigawatts. And by the time the film got the green light, it was 1984. The DeLorean car had come and gone, and John DeLorean was in trial for his indictment, legal issues. And so with the DeLorean sort of being in the news and being sort of more pervasive in culture, Bob Zemeckis and Bob Gale saw it on TV one day and thought, you know, that car looks really futuristic, and it would be more practical to have the time machine on wheels instead of having to be carted around in the back of this truck. Why don't we just put the time machine in a DeLorean? And that was really all it took. The sort of funny thing that happened with that is that the DeLorean is a really, really bad car. I don't know if you've ever driven one.
No,
or any of your listeners have, but they're really bad cars. They're cars that, you know, if you can get one up to 88 miles per hour, you know, that's good for you. So they had a lot of trouble with the DeLorean during filming, especially on that third film, which took place in the Old West. It was just difficult just keeping that car functioning.
So what impact did Back to the Future have on the film industry after its release and since then?
Well, I think really two things. First, it really upped the ante in terms of what you need to do to make a successful summer blockbuster. You know, Back to the Future is a really smart film. It's a wholesome film. It's a fun film, but it's not a lazy film. It's a film that really requires patience from the audience, especially in the beginning as the exposition is being set up. And there are so many payoffs for people that really watch that you see in films like The Dark Knight and the first Jurassic Park and these other sort of heftier summer blockbusters, more attention to story, I think. The other really important piece of the legacy of Back to the Future is the crew that came out of those films. You know, Kathleen Kennedy was a producer, an executive producer on Back to the Future. She is now spearheading the new Star Wars films. So many people that have worked on these movies, costume designers, special effects people, have gone on to win Academy Awards for other films. And for a lot of them, their first among their first jobs in Hollywood was this film or these three films. So you know, it was really special, and people, a lot of creative people, came together at the right point in time.
Well, you mentioned Star Wars, that it seems like the secret to success in Hollywood these days is a sequel or a reboot of an already successful franchise. Could this happen with Back to the Future?
Absolutely not. Luckily, Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale had in their contract that they retain rights to Back to the Future, and that they are unable, Universal is unable to remake or reboot as long as either Bob Zemeckis or Bob Gale are alive. And they're not going anywhere anytime soon, and they have no interest in rebooting or remaking this film.
So nothing to do but watch the original. Cassian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Cassian Gaines, author of the new book, We Don't Need Roads, The Making of the Back to the Future Trilogy, as we mark the 30th anniversary today of the release of the original, Back to the Future. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard is out today. With the 4th of July weekend kicking off, there are a few foods that seem more all-American than the hot dog. As we'll find out, there are a lot of regional and ethnic variations to enjoy. Bruce Craig is a culinary historian and expert on the lore, allure, and culture of the hot dog. He's the author of Man Bites Dog, Hot Dog Culture in America, and Hot Dogs, A Global History. He joins us now for Food Friday. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
So 4th of July weekend, hot dogs often in the list of the all-American things. How did hot dogs become such an all-American food in the public mind?
Well, there's an apocryphal story about William Tecumseh Sherman or other generals who said, when asked why they were successful, "I got there fustest with the mostest." So hot dogs were the first prepackaged food product that's easy to serve to in public functions, and it's meat, and Americans are majorly carnivores. So hot dogs begin early, and they retain their power.
They're kind of, in some ways, the first fast food.
Well, they are. There are others like peanuts after the Civil War, for example, and then after the 1890s, popcorn. But hot dogs have been a street food since at least the 1870s. And since, again, Americans are major carnivores, this is a quick and easy way to get meat. And so they are, they're maybe the first fast food. Mm-hmm.
And we'll get into the food side of things in a bit, but in your book, you also write about what hot dogs tell us about who we are as Americans. So what kind of meaning do we read into hot dogs? What do they tell us about ourselves?
Right. Well, hot dogs are just part of American mythology. I mean, think about the elements that describe our popular culture and move our popular culture, advertising jingles. And I know because I watch Mad Men. And nobody ever said hamburgers and donuts and football. They said baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and a car company. So it's deep in our cultural history. And again, the reason is because they were there first. And what they tell us is a story of immigration, because it is immigrant food. Naturalized in to become American. It's convenient, fast, and cheap, which Americans like in their food. It's amenable to regional variations, so it becomes embedded in local culture, and that's why there's so many regional and very local styles. And it's always associated with the great American game, baseball. And it has been since the 1880s. Probably. So, and also fairs and public events that we really like 4th of July or going to Coney Island or amusement parks. So hot dogs are there to begin with.
So one of the most mysterious things to me about hot dogs has always been the name. It's half right. They're usually served hot. Dogs, I don't know where that comes from. Why are they called hot dogs?
Well, it's an ancient joke, and it goes back. In America, the earliest that anybody's found, I think, is from the 1840s, but it certainly goes back into medieval Europe. People are always worried what goes into the butchers' grinding machines, right? Because hot dogs are, after all, a ground meat, or chopped meat, actually, and then later ground up, but chopped. So you never know what's going in there. And the standard joke in the Middle Ages and in America was, if a butcher opened up in a neighborhood, all the dogs and cats disappeared. So I think you've heard that before with other ethnic cuisines.
Right.
But it started with hot dogs. So there's always been this suspicion and rules about this. And medieval European towns had lots of rules about what butchers could do and what they could put in their sausages. So there's always this suspicion. And the joke is runs right through American history. So I'll mention a popular song to you, written in 1864 by a Philadelphia songwriter, one of the most famous songwriters in American history. His name was Septimus Winner in original German. And it's written in comic German dialect. And it is, oh, where has my little dog gone? Oh, where can he be? Right? Everybody knows.
Uh-huh, right.
You don't know the last line. The last line goes something like this. Ein Sausage ist gut, Bologna ist gut. They make him it horse, they make him it dog. I guess they make him it he.
Oh, no. Okay.
Oh, yeah. And sometime, we don't know when exactly, but the word first appears in the 1880s. Somebody put together hot, which, by the way, was a very popular word for things back in the late 19th century. For example, politicians who were hot to go to war were called red hots. And, you know, wanted to go to the war in the Philippines, Cuba, you know, everywhere, and they're called red hots. So red hot is a popular word. Somebody put these two together, hot, red hot, and dog, and it appeared again in the mid-1880s. And then it becomes really popular by the 1890s and is used everywhere. And the joke is always the same. Because if you look at cartoons and jokes like this and songs like, you know, about butchers putting dogs in their machines, there are songs about this. Cartoons, as I said, vaudeville jokes, it's everywhere.
Wow.
And even iconography, you'll see in a number of hot dog stands a dog in a bun, right?
Uh-huh.
And if you go online, you'll find real dogs they have bun costumes, you know, hot dog bun costumes for your little dogs. So the joke is still there. It's American humor, you know?
We're talking to Bruce Craig, culinary historian, about the history and the present of hot dogs in America. Now, Bruce, let's put those actual dogs out of our mind and talk about some of the ways we eat the real thing. We're sharing some recipes on our Central Time Facebook page. You've got one for a Washington State hot dog. It sounds like a good fit for Wisconsin, too. Cheddar cheese and apples in this one. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, in doing research on books, I talked to a number of people, not just chefs, but also companies who make up recipes for their products. In fact, one of the best ones is a book published by Murray Handwerker, the son of Nathan Handwerker, who founded Nathan's Hot Dogs. And he did a hot dog book back in the 60s with various toppings on it. This wasn't in it, Washington State, but many others are. It's really interesting historically. So anyway, this comes from Washington State, and it's supposed to represent what Washington produces best, and that is apples, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't see why it couldn't be Wisconsin. And cheddar cheese, well, you know, there are Washington State cheeses like Tillamook or Cougar Gold at Washington State University. So I think Wisconsin ought to take that over. Maybe cranberries, too.
All right, yeah, that would work with that combo. So this is just one of those regional variations you mentioned. How did we end up with this huge regional variety of hot dogs in this country?
Well, that's so interesting. This goes to the question of how come there are no hot dog chains like hamburgers?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's a really local food, and it's very humble and homely. I mean, there are two reasons for it, one of which has to do with Wisconsin directly. And the one reason is hot dogs became kids' food, especially beginning in the 1930s and then accelerated in the 1950s. And this was done by the Oscar Mayer Company, located in, what city that's in?
Not too far from where I'm sitting right now.
Yeah, not far from you. Although they originated in Chicago, but they bought plant up in the 1920s. So that's the center for it. And they deliberately marketed to kids, beginning with little Oscar, who was a small person who had appeared at the World's Fair in Chicago. They had a little, they had a midget village, and seriously, and one of the Oscar Myers went to it and saw it and said, gee, maybe this should be our logo, because then we can appeal to kids. So they began doing so, and so the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile is part of that campaign. And then in the 1950s, everybody knows their jingles, right? I wish I were an Oscar Mayer Wiener.
Sure.
And others. So they market through television directly to children. So you can't take that product that's a supermarket product and market it to kids and turn it into a national chain. It's just too ordinary, I think. And so that's one reason. And the other is that hot dogs are, by the time the national chains like hamburgers arise, particularly after World War II with McDonald's, is that they were too embedded in local culture. So the regional variations and the local types develop in the 1890s to 1900s and then accelerate after that. So they were invented by immigrants who opened hot dog stands and put their own toppings on them to differentiate them from anybody else. So I'll give you a couple of examples. One is in New Jersey, there are two kinds of Texas wieners. Now, they have nothing to do with Texas. This is it's a hot dog in the New York, New Jersey style. That's a fairly plain, natural casing, kind of long. And the sauce on it is a thin tomato sauce that's seasoned with a little nutmeg and cinnamon and a couple of other things. Not as heavy as Cincinnati, but a milder version. And that was invented sometime before 1920 by Greek immigrants who took the same kind of sauce they put in moussaka, they put it on the hot dog. And once one hot dog stand, you know, a Greek immigrant comes to live in northern New Jersey, say Newark, where one of the styles comes from, and his relatives come over because it's, you know, you can make a living. They came from really poor parts of Greece. And so people open hot dog stands, and one fellow puts this sauce on, then everybody has to do it. And the local people eating hot dogs like it, and it becomes the style in that part of northern New Jersey, say Patterson or whatever it is. And again, there are two different styles, closely related but different. And the other is a Detroit Coney.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a similar story, invented by Greek immigrants who came to Detroit about 1914, which is the era when a number of hot dog stands grew up and mostly run by immigrants, Greeks, Jews, Italians. And they invented a similar kind of sauce, but thicker and with meat in it. And they called it a Coney, and the reason they called it Coney is because of Coney Island, because everybody knew that Coney Island was the great resort area and is a great cultural cachet, and so they called their hot dog stand Coney. There are two of them, most famous ones, American and American Coney and Lafayette Coney Island, right?
And I grew up on those American Coney dogs growing up in southeastern Michigan. We'll hear more about regional variations on the hot dog with Bruce Craig, author of Man Bites Dog, Hot Dog Culture in America. And we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite way to prepare hot dogs? Maybe a favorite regional version of the hot dog? And you go all beef, pork, turkey, chicken, or veggie? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave your question or comment on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Bruce Craig on this week's edition of Food Friday. He's a culinary historian and expert on hot dogs. His books include Man Bites Dog, Hot Dog Culture in America. You can join in with your favorite way to prepare a hot dog, a favorite regional variation. Are you a purist or do you load it up with the condiments? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got some recipes. You can try them out maybe this holiday weekend. We'll go right to a caller now. We've got Carol on the line in Glendale. Carol, hi.
Hi, hello, yes. So far as the widespread popularity of hot dogs, I spend time in Puerto Rico and on the small island of Vieques every year. And, in Vieques, there are a couple of places that are, you know, hot dog places. There are hot dog stands, and there's a stand in Old San Juan in the heart of things and that serve hot dogs, shoestring potatoes. You can get relish, the whole thing. You can onions, sauerkraut is popular.
Okay, interesting. So San Juan, a big hot dog town, Puerto Rico, big hot dogs in general. Carol, thanks for the call. Bruce, is there a famous Puerto Rican twist on the hot dog?
I think that they're sort of Caribbean, and it would be in common with Caribbean or Latin American, and they would have and by the way, these styles are now coming to America, often have mayonnaise on them and French fries put on top and chili sauces of various kinds. So they're really loaded up in a lot of ways, and I suspect that Puerto Rican ones are kind of like that.
That all works for me. Carol, thanks a lot for that call. What's your favorite way, Bruce, to eat a hot dog? Is there one that you encountered that's really your go-to?
Well, since I'm in Chicago, I really do like the Chicago-style hot dog.
It's hard to go wrong. What's the key to serving it Chicago-style that we'll know it's the real deal?
Yeah, well, they're hot water-bathed. They could be steamed. Hot water-bathed, only just so long. So that they and should be natural casing, so that it has the right snap. It isn't rubbery or something, and it's got to have fresh condiments on it. They have to have crunch and snap in them. And you know, a Chicago hot dog has got mustard and fresh onions. It can have bright green relish, tomatoes, pickle spears, and hot peppers, and if you want, celery salt. But it's a whole meal in itself and a symphony, I might say, of flavors and textures.
Now, when I've had Chicago dogs, the celery salt for me is not optional. That's what really makes it for me.
Oh, really? Well, that's pretty interesting. It's not all that popular, but, you know, it's part of...
Well, I'm not from Chicago, to be fair.
No, you're from Southeast Michigan.
Exactly. Another one I liked that you had a recipe for in your book, and this gets to the ethnic side of this, a Korean barbecue-flavored hot dog with kimchi. And we've got this on our program note and on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us about that variety.
This is a newer style, and it was made popular by a food truck in Los Angeles called Kogi, which the chef is quite famous, a fellow named Choi, who's quite famous now. And you see him on TV quite a bit, who married Korean and American foods, which is perfectly natural since there's so many Americans in Korea and so many Koreans in Los Angeles. So instead of sauerkraut, you have kimchi. And it's not just one, you know, there are like 100 different kinds of kimchi. In fact, there's a museum in Korea called the Kimchi Museum where they have on display 100 different kinds of kimchi. So you can make any variation out of that. It's really quite good because kimchi is eaten with all sorts of meats and other foods of all kinds. So it goes really well. Asian styles have become popular, not just kimchi, but there's a mini chain called Japa Dog, which has Japanese condiments on it. It is one in New York and started in Vancouver. So this is just one of that variation. It can be, you know, if the original local styles were Greek and Macedonian, Balkan in origin, so why not Asian?
Go back to our callers. We've got Karen on the line in Woodstock, Illinois. Karen, hi.
Hi. Fun topic. My husband and I love to have a good old backyard hot dog cooked on a charcoal grill, and we like to just get it nice and crispy and then butter the buns and then grill the buns, and that's like to us the perfect hot dog. But I was wondering if your guest, I'm looking for a really wonderful, they're called Texas Hots, but it's like a tomatoey based sauce with hamburger, and I think that has some of that cinnamon and a few other ingredients, and it's just delicious. And I've seen these places, even as like New York State, but it's a standard Texas hot sauce for hot dogs.
Karen, thanks for the call. Is that that Texas dog that actually exists in New Jersey, Bruce?
Correct. It's not from Texas at all. So I've never seen a sauce like that for sale on the market. It could be in New Jersey. I've never seen it there either. But there are recipes online, and you can just try it. Make it yourself.
For the Texas sauce, or you could get, you said it was, what kind of Greek sauce was adapted into this?
Well, a tomato base, the kind you use in moussaka.
All right. Well, Bruce,
with meat or without.
Bruce, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun talking hot dogs.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
That was Bruce Craig. He's a culinary historian, expert on the lore, allure, culture, and history of the hot dog. His books include Man Bites Dog, Hot Dog Culture in America, and Hot Dogs, A Global History. Well, still time for you to tell us how you take and serve and cook your hot dogs over at the Central Time Facebook page. Is there only one way to go for you? Boiled, steamed, fried, grilled? What, of course, toppings do you put on? Just straight up yellow mustard? A little sauerkraut? Ketchup? Okay, we'll accept that too. Central Time Facebook page, and you can get some recipes for different ways to serve hot dogs over the holiday weekend. That's the Central Time Facebook page.